Linda, this is Boone, North Carolina, Reel 4. I'm talking to Bob Gaston, who is property master for Horn in the West. Bob, in terms of our survey, we're looking for procedures that may work. We're also trying to identify some of the problems that have either been solved or not been solved. I understand you're handling props here for the first time, and wanted to ask you some of the problems that you had run into in taking on the very difficult job of props for such a big show as this. There doesn't have to be any order particularly about this this conversation, just whatever comes to mind in terms of the things that you've had to do in order to organize the show that you think either might be different from indoor or that just seem to be big problems, period, are the things that we'd be interested in knowing about.
Well, it seemed like at the first night when Mabel left, the biggest help I had in the world were her notes. Hadn't been for a complete set of notes, you know, I'd have been completely lost. But I've been adding to them as I've gone along because there's little things that pop up, you know, that need to be taken care of. So I'm keeping a set of notes, too.
Now, of notes, you mean notes that indicate what goes on and which scene and from which side of the stage and that sort of thing.
Every little thing.
How many props do you have in this show, or is this a fair question, Gene, Bob?
Oh, I guess there are about 100.
I'd say closer to 400.
Really, closer to 400. That's a lot to keep track of.
A lot of them he's not even aware of yet. I mean, because they had been given to the cast before he ever got involved in it. See?
Oh, I see.
So he isn't even aware of these props because they have become personal props.
Well, you divide the personal props then, making the actors responsible for those. Is that correct?
Yes, they are responsible for those.
And then you are mainly concerned with props that must be either available off stage or must be in place on stage.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Like in the study in the cabin and things that are carried on for the Exodus and picnic.
Do you have a crew to assist you, Bob, or is it just a matter of organizing the cast so that they give you help at specific times?
Well, I do just about all of it by myself. There's and I have relatively enough time to do everything. It doesn't rush me.
I would like to ask, too, if you have a system of checking on the props, or that is for damage or for repainting or anything that might be necessary in keeping the props first class, or do you pass this responsibility on to the various cast members to inform you?
Well,
or is it a matter of everybody working together on it? I mean, what is your focal point?
Sort of both of them. If there's something I handle every time, I check on it and fix it up if it needs it. And if it, like it's a personal prop, you know, like they're responsible for, and it gets damaged or needs repairing, they give it to me and I fix it. And just say little things like that.
Do you keep a prop inventory by weeks or just by season? I mean, a complete listing of what you're supposed to have and what's available and what sort of shape it's in.
Well, that's all in the notes.
That's all in the notes.
Yeah. It's not listed, it's sort of diagrammed.
Do you have, when you say diagram, does this mean you have a plot of the props that you go by for each scene?
Well, yeah, for
like
the scenes.
Like a floor plan of the stage?
Yeah, we have a floor plan for the stage and for the turntable. And for the picnic, too, we have to have a diagram for that. And that's about it, really.
Are you required to help set any of the special effects, or do the technical people do all of that? By that, I mean the battle scenes or the Indian fire and so on. Are those classed as props or as special technical things?
I take care of the Indian fire and I load shells for the rifles.
You do your own loading primers and so on for the rifles. What type of rifles do you use? You have a number of them that must operate. I know One of our other shows down on the coast was severely criticized by having some rather modern type firearms in it.
Yes, these are Civil War rifles.
Come on over, Gene.
They're 1873 Springfields, 4570 trapdoor model. It's the first cartridge loading rifle, practical cartridge loading rifle that was used, and it looks like an old muzzle loader. It looks like the old, pretty much on the stage that we're at. It looks close enough like it, and it also, when we load it, you see, any modern rifle, you got a bolt on there, or a pump action, or something like this, and this has got a great big hammer, just like an old-fashioned flintlock, because what it was modified from a percussion and flintlock rifle. And so it's got the big hammer, and it looks just like the other one, but it still loads with the cartridge, which we have to have.
This loading backstage, I don't know, you've got a number of shots in this that you have to load for. Does this become quite a project, getting accurate powder measurements and so on, so you don't blow any of them up?
Well, we have a standard we go by. We just fill the shell up till it's full to the top and just pack it down. And with that pistol, you know, didn't go off. You remember it, the first time we shot it didn't go.
The cap fired and the load didn't fire, yes.
Well, we've had a time with that.
Well, these rifles in themselves are rather museum pieces and of some collector value, aren't they, Gene?
When we first started getting them, I could get one for $35. Today it cost me $65. Same rifle.
Well, that gives me an idea of what's happening on that. Firearms collecting has become quite a hobby, which has nothing to do with this tape, however. Do you have, in terms of storage backstage for the props, do you have particular problems because of weather or weather damage, or is everything able to stand the weather?
There's no problem as far as I know. The only thing is tablecloths getting wet, and that's solved easily enough with the dryer.
I understood from costume mistress that you had a dryer backstage for that sort of thing. How about the draperies on the interior sets?
We only have one set of drapes, and we keep those covered with that tarpaulin. And the only time they get wet is during the show if it rained.
Bob, is there anything you want to add?
No.
Well, thank you very much. Linda, this is Bob Gaston, property master for Horn in the West, at Boone, North Carolina, July 20, 1966. Linda, I suppose we might head this report on the 1966 production of Horn in the West, Boone, North Carolina. The 1966 production, scenically, is one of the most attractive of the outdoor dramas. The scenery is done in a semi-realistic, or perhaps we can borrow Tommy Rizzuto's phrase, romantic realism style. It is mostly made of fiberglass, very light in terms of its bulk, and scenery units such as walls, gates, log cabins, rocks, tremendous rocks that people can stand on, are all very light, quite realistic in the terms of realism selected to project in the outdoor theater. When necessary, quite colorful, but not dominating, make this a very attractive show when combined with the costumes. The costumes are obviously authentic in design, but the color has been intensified in order to add color to a production that otherwise might be very drab. In terms of the acting, the production probably is not as good as the one last year in an overall sense. This production suffers from the fact that although the age, the voice strength, and ability to project of three of the principal characters is very good, their technique at reaction is very poor, based primarily on the fact that these really are area actors who have grown up to play the leads. They are among the most mature in the cast, extremely effective, partially, but all with handicaps that handicap the professionalism of the production. This is a general statement, and I can be more specific perhaps when I rewrite this report. Among the minor characters and the lesser principals, the acting is effective, except in terms of its youth. This company apparently suffered a decrease in the general ability and background of the secondary and minor actors this year. The dancing is effective in terms of giving the environmental quality or the storytelling quality as necessary to both the Indians and to the settlers. The dances of the settlers have been advanced just a little bit toward show dancing, in the sense that that certain props and certain patterns have been added purely for their theatrical effect. However, the root or the base of the dancing is still in the authentic origin of either square dancing or of the essential Indian dance. Certainly, the dancing of the principal Indian scene at the end of the first act is one of the highlights that makes this show come off at all. The directing is generally competent, but based more on an effectiveness of what works rather than any apparent patterns or theories as to upstage, downstage. This theater, for all its size of its auditorium, does not offer great space problems in terms of tying together the scenes. However, the director has on various occasions missed, in my opinion, opportunities to flow the action from side stage to main stage or from main stage to side stage, as the case may be. I feel that the use of the lighting, which is generally effective illumination and effective mood lighting, as a focal arrangement, is an easy way past problems that could be solved from a directorial point of view more effectively. As an example, I might say that when this action shifts even momentarily from side stage to main stage, the side stage is blacked out, the main stage is lighting. If the action flows back, then the reverse is done, the main stage is killed and the side stage is lighted. I don't think that the degree of cutting the lights all the way out to make these points is as effective as it would be to simply subdue the lighting in one area and put the brilliance in another. I think the director has perhaps gone too far in using the lighting to handle his focus. Perhaps this was due to the fact that the focus was difficult to achieve, or he felt it was difficult to achieve in other terms. The crowds in this play are effective in terms of their motion design, but they're not effective in terms of their action-reaction to the situation. There are mostly young people making up the bulk of this cast, but they react not in terms of individual personalities, but in terms of individuals in a cheering section or at a football game. This is an era we've seen at numbers of the other dramas where the crowd reaction is a specific youth reaction without depth. And I think this causes the production to suffer in some respect. The reactions are therefore not, it isn't that they're not convincing, it's that they are without depth, and that the lack of depth is toward the youth of the performers, and you feel that everybody is really not cheering the action, but is cheering a football game. It is a very subtle defeat of the playwright in these scenes, and as I say, it appears to be, to a certain extent, general to the field, and not really an individual problem of Horn in the West. Perhaps the makeup in terms of making up people older or of giving people individual age and character reactions in every crowd scene could break this up. Certainly, depth in the reactions is one thing sincerely and severely needed in this production. There's little evidence of the shouting in this play that outdoor drama's been criticized for. The principals all have strong voices, and although we've commented on some lack of reaction here, I feel that the director has gotten a good bit of effectiveness out of his actors. Essentially, it is a younger, less experienced group, and I feel this is the reason for the various errors that I've observed in handling the action of the play. Perhaps this play leans, for its strength, a little bit too much toward technical theater, which includes the battle scenes, the Indian scenes, the major dance scenes, in which effects are contribute perhaps more than they ought to. Now, I don't mean to infer that the technical aspects should be minimized, but only that the rest of the play does not measure up to the emphasis given to the technical aspects of the production. In a certain sense, this play would be much weaker if it wasn't for a thorough working over of technical aspects. The possible exception in this is the sound. This may be a personal prejudice on my part, but the use of sound equipment, including a microphone for the narrator or the Judge Henderson figure at one point, seems to me to defeat the reality, to make the audience conscious that they are seeing a play. I found certain aspects of this to be true at the Common Glory, where I felt the sound boosting or the sound effects or the sound handling of the music was unnecessary. The music in the production is effective for what it is. My only objection is that certain of the sound levels, to me, are too loud in terms of balancing with the cast of the play. To go back for a moment to a specific aspect, the acting of the principal character in this play is very wooden. This is the Dr. Stewart character. The voice is good, the gesture is good, but it is wooden. It is, in a sense, mechanical and non-acting. This leads to a lack of warmth in terms of the audience response to this character. A character who can't sweat, cannot really grieve, he cannot really be someone who suffers in making a decision, and the writing of this play definitely throws the sympathy of the audience and the attention of the audience to Dr. Stewart. However, with the cold acting and mechanical acting that takes place, it means the director has had to split the drive of the central character into three parts, one to Preacher Sims, one to Daniel Boone, and the other, of course, remaining with Dr. Stewart. This literally means that the play is a three-headed device in production, whereas it should concentrate upon the struggle faced by Dr. Stewart. This is the original intention of the playwright, not so much from my inference here, although it's in the script, but from my conversations with the playwright some 15 years ago when this play was first written. The director, in solving this problem, has made probably the only decision he could, in that he has allowed the focus to split along these three characters, and then has made the story of the play the story of the pioneers. Essentially, this device is a substitute and a cover-up for the general ineffectiveness in the acting, not in the playwriting. I have the feeling that this play If some of these principles were shifted around, it might be far more effective. The character of Daniel Boone, which is allowed to feature strongly in this play, is not really anything other than a color and environmental character, but the Daniel Boone in acting supplies much of the leadership and force of the action of the play, and tends to split up the audience's sympathetic empathy with any single leading figure. I feel the error is more in the production than it is in the playwriting. However, the total play, because of the director's decision, tends to work, and the audiences seem to enjoy it. I would like to add one comment about the treatment of the audience. My feeling is that the manager and the front of the house management is more concerned with the comfort and care of the audience. I was dreadfully upset about this last year, and the tendency of the intermission salesman of the concession goods, unfortunately, is still a horribly disruptive factor in terms of the mood established in the audience, and the cast has to start all over again.